Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So, John Kerry wins the second round. But the fight for the Democratic nomination and the party's blessing to take on George Bush has plenty more rounds to go. Last night in New Hampshire, Howard Dean showed he's still a contender with his second place showing. Wesley Clark and John Edwards virtually tied for third place and say they still hope to blow the race wide open as the contest heads south and west this week. Next Tuesday, 269 convention delegates are up for grabs when seven states go to the polls: Arizona, Delaware, and Missouri, North Dakota, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and South Carolina. Tonight on Point, the Democratic primary campaign goes national. We'll open the lens to see what's out there. What do you make of the New Hampshire results and the road ahead for the Democrats? Does Kerry have it in the bag, halfway in, or is it still a wide open race? And what do you see waiting for the Democratic contenders on the national stage? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. She's just returned home from New Hampshire. And Susan Page, we're delighted to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Tom, it's good to be with you.
It's good to be with you. And with me in the studio tonight, down from snowy Manchester, New Hampshire, to snowy Boston, Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine and On Point's News Analyst. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Susan.
So, Susan Page, what's the shorthand you're giving us for the results in New Hampshire last night? What does it mean? How does this stand now? How many people still really in the race? How significant the lead that John Kerry brings out of Iowa and New Hampshire?
You know, John Kerry is in a remarkable position. I mean, let's not forget that on January 1st, we thought he was out of the running.
Yeah.
Now he's clearly the front runner. He's in a commanding position, but it's not over yet. It's still possible that he'll campaign badly, that someone else will have a surge, but he's certainly in the position that every other candidate wishes they were in, and he's in the position that Howard Dean thought he was going to be in at this point in the contest.
When John Kerry looks at the national stage, or a big slice of it anyway, coming up next Tuesday, is it more of the same? Can he take his same message, his same demeanor, his same approach across this big swath of states from east to west and into the south? Or does he have to fine-tune this week, Susan?
You know, it's a different kind of campaign now. It's less of this retail person-to-person campaigning that we see in Iowa and New Hampshire. There are just too many states over too much territory for that. So you have to rely more on TV ads and tarmac appearances. And, you know, it's also different parts of the country. We'll have a contest next Tuesday in South Carolina, the first southern state to vote, the first state with a large African-American population to vote, and also some contests in the West in places like Arizona and New Mexico and Oklahoma. So I think there are some differences. These are places where John Kerry is not well-known. He's spent a fair amount of time in Iowa, and, of course, he's from New Hampshire's neighboring state, so he's better known in those places than he'll be in the places where these next contests will be held.
Susan, Senator Kerry coming out of New Hampshire last night with 39% of the primary vote there. Howard Dean, former governor of Vermont, coming out with 26% in second place. Where does that place him now? It's clearly better than he did in Iowa, but it's not exactly breathing down Kerry's neck. What do these two back-to-back primaries, caucus and primary, mean for him looking forward?
Well, I think Howard Dean is a disappointed man, and word late today that he is shaking up his campaign staff. His campaign manager, Joe Trippi, has quit.
He's quit now. Is that formal?
That's right. He's put out a statement wishing Dean well and announcing that he's resigned.
And, of course, Joe Trippi was the kind of Internet guru who really helped propel Dean from little-known former governor to top of the Democratic field for a while there.
That's right. Joe Trippi is a very interesting, kind of dynamic, almost a little wacky guy who seemed to be a really good fit with Dean and the kind of campaign he was running. But, you know, after two losses in states where they thought they were going to win, it's not surprising, I think, that Dean would move to shake up his campaign. He's installing Rory Neal at the top of his campaign. Rory Neal is a guy who came up through the political ranks as an assistant and advisor to Al Gore. So it'll be interesting to see if Gore plays a somewhat greater role in the campaign now.
Why Al Gore's main man? Rory Neal, if I've got it right, worked for Gore from 1977 to 94 and then was deputy chief of staff for Bill Clinton. But why a long-time Al Gore man, given that Al Gore did not sweep it away in 2000?
That's right. Well, you know, of course, a lot of Democrats think Al Gore did win the 2000 election.
But he didn't sweep it away, clearly.
That's true. That's true. You know, I think it's probably more for Roy Neal's qualities than for Al Gore's. Roy Neal is a very reassuring, mature, senior kind of guy. At the Clinton White House, he was the deputy chief of staff who, you know, that White House was youthful and often chaotic, and he was a guy who brought kind of a measure of stability and common sense to it. And I think those are probably qualities that were appealing to Howard Dean.
Talk to us about Wesley Clark and John Edwards. Wesley Clark by a nose in third place, virtually tied with John Edwards there. How do they look as they head south?
You know, disappointing, I think, for both men. Wesley Clark, you remember, skipped Iowa in hopes of scoring well in New Hampshire. He thought he was going to be the alternative to Howard Dean. He was squeezed out of that position once John Kerry came back so strongly in Iowa. So I think he's looking for a place where he can win, and I think a disappointing finish last night. The same, really, for John Edwards. He had this remarkable surge at the end in Iowa, came in second. None of us saw that coming. I think that he had hopes of finishing third in New Hampshire, and the fact that he didn't quite do it, I mean, it was only 1,000 votes that he trailed Clark, but the fact that he didn't manage to inch his way into third place, I think, takes a little bit of the shine off his remarkable finish in Iowa. He now goes to South Carolina. That was his first stop. He flew there, in fact, to South Carolina last night, did an event there this morning. He was born in South Carolina. He's talking about that. But that is a state he must win on Tuesday if his campaign is going to continue to have some legs.
Jack Beatty, what do you see looking out here nationally? I'm looking at polls, and of course, polls, polls, polls. Nevertheless, Arizona, here's a poll that puts Kerry ahead. South Carolina, Edwards in the lead. Oklahoma, Clark in the lead. Another poll, a little bit older, but in New Mexico, Dean in the lead. Here we are, out of little Iowa and little New Hampshire and on a very big stage.
Yeah, I have to feel that out of like causes, you get like results. And what we're seeing is that Democrats want a winner. The electability, which is sometimes salient, but often not, people vote their hearts, they vote their preferences. That seems to just be the overwhelming criterion that Democrats have. And in two states, states not with really dissimilar states, people have said, yep, he's got it. So I guess I would bet that that's going for Kerry, that what the vote, what they want, which is electability. That seems to be what the voters have said.
So you're confident saying that even before he's had the test of the southern electorate, the western electorate, the mountain states?
That could clearly skew it. But, you know, I think one of his biggest problems now is the press. And I want to ask Susan about this. Susan, you know that in 2000, Mickey Kouse of Slate magazine went to New Hampshire, and he wrote a piece. He said, oh, I get it now. The press hates Al Gore. And you know, he cited, and we, you know as well as I do, the work of C.C. Connolly of The Post and Catherine Seeley of The Times, who pretty much distorted something Al Gore said about the inventing the Internet. He didn't say that. And that became a kind of urban legend. Now, do you feel, I sense this feeling about the press toward Kerry. Give us some candor here. Are you hearing anything like that?
You know, I spent the part of the weekend traveling with John Kerry. I spent all day Sunday with him. I was doing a piece that ran in this morning's USA Today, still just 50 cents, by the way. But spending Sunday with John Kerry and on the bus with the reporters who travel with him every day, you know, there's a small group of reporters that are with him at every event in every state of this campaign. And I think that I think he has reasonably good relations with his press corps. I think he has, in fact, friendlier relations with his press corps than Howard Dean has with his. I think it's easy, though, to overstate the importance of whether reporters like you. You know, the candidate that reporters like often is not the candidate who wins elections. Reporters loved John McCain 4 years ago. Well, who got the nomination? It was George Bush. And in other elections, too, going back before my time, back to elections, say, with Richard Nixon as a candidate. But I take your point that that it can make some difference. And I thought he seemed to get along pretty well with his press corps. He came back on the bus on one of the late legs when it was late. He had been campaigning all day, and we had been watching him. Came back and spoke in a kind of casual, off-the-record way with reporters. I didn't see kind of the seeds of hostility that you can sometimes see in the strains of a campaign.
Susan, put your reporter's hat on for a minute. USA Today, you're clearly got a national audience there. What's the shorthand description of John Kerry? When you plug in that paragraph that says who this man is for the rest of the country that may not know him so well, and polls show a lot of people don't feel they really know the candidates well yet, what's in a nutshell, how do you say, here's who John Kerry is?
Well, I think you say two things that have different, may resonate in different ways with voters in other places. You say, four-term senator from Massachusetts. You know, that's a positive for some people and a negative for others.
Yep.
And you say, Vietnam War hero, decorated Vietnam veteran. And I think that's a pretty positive thing almost any place you go.
So that works. We've got callers who want to join us, and I want to bring them right in. Sarah's calling from Kingston, Massachusetts. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
I had a question. What are your reasons that you give for John Kerry jumping ahead? Because I was just wondering, one reason that I might have is just energy in his campaign staff. Like, is that, do you think, like, with the recent layoffs in his campaign staff that, you know, coming back together in Iowa and then over to New Hampshire may have been a reason?
Sarah, let us pick it up. Susan Page, what do you say to that?
Yes,
why?
Sir, you were asking about changes in John Kerry's campaign staff.
Yeah, the phone line's a little rugged there, but why this Kerry surge in Iowa and New Hampshire? She said she felt energy in the campaign staff. Mm-hmm. If the campaign staff was driving this,
When I interviewed Kerry on Sunday, he talked about how much more comfortable he was campaigning once he had shaken up his staff toward the end of last year. There had been a lot of he had a really talented staff, but they were fighting with each other, and there were a lot of times when I gather he was getting cell phone calls from one aide or another arguing some point. He says he's felt much more comfortable and the campaign has run more smoothly since then. So that could certainly be one factor. You know, I think another thing is that Dean kind of seized the moment toward the end of last year. He was the hot candidate. He was interesting. He was passionate. A lot of Democrats were drawn to him. I think there was a point a couple weeks ago when many Democrats in these early states, especially Iowa, started to take a second look and raise the question, does he have the temperament to be president? Is he an electable? If you nominate him, can he beat George Bush? That was an opening that John Kerry then was able to take advantage of.
Mm. Jack Beatty, everybody clearly in this lineup, or most of the candidates, owe a real debt to Howard Dean for the energy that he brought to the whole season, for the language and the kind of fierceness even that he brought. They may have moderated it and modified it some, but you can hear it in the rhetoric of almost every candidate, that energy and that language flowing. Yet, I saw him today talking, and there's a kind of a, I don't know, there's this more gentle tone, more modest tone. Even I thought I picked up a little note of resignation in Howard Dean's public comments today.
I had the same – this is an NPR interview. I had the same reaction. He mentioned there I have to – he seemed to be saying, I'm going to go through these states because I owe it to people to send them as delegates to the convention. That's not saying I'm going to go through these states to win. It may have been a slip of the tongue, but it did seem resigned. And, you know, he just lost the state that bordered his state. He was governor for 10 years of the neighboring state. It's in the Vermont media market, insofar as there is one.
Yep.
And he lost big.
Susan Page, still the fire in the Dean campaign?
You know, I think he's – first of all, let's not forget how tired these guys are.
Sure.
I mean, they've been campaigning.
Yeah. Let's be human and fair.
I'm exhausted. I don't have to be on stage in lights.
Right.
So I think that's probably one factor. And the way you get your energy is by winning. Well, instead of having some good nights, he's had some bad ones. He's also now in this terrible box because if he speaks with passion and anger like he did on that Monday night a week ago after his disappointing third-place finish in Iowa – he reinforces these questions about his temperament. But if he doesn't, if he's subdued, then it looks like he's lost the fire that really lit his campaign. It's a really difficult situation for a candidate to be in, and it makes it hard for him at this particular moment when he really needs to be attacking John Kerry. It makes it harder for him to do that effectively.
Susan Page, it's great having you tonight. Thanks. We know you've been out on that campaign trail, and you'll be out there again. We really appreciate a few minutes with you tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, that's something incredible. When you abuse your strong suit, and Dean's passion was his strong suit, when he pushed it a little over the edge in Iowa, now the very thing that has been such a strength for him is practically off limits. If he gets close to that volume, again, Susan's saying, people are going to start cringing and wondering if he goes.
It's like a Greek myth, isn't it? I mean, the very thing that's making him strong makes him weak. He can't put the metal to the floor because immediately people are going to say temperament and so on. But you're right. In a way, even if he's failing, we don't know whether he is, he has done something to this campaign. He has taken it up another notch in their attack on Bush.
And who knows, with this last week of more gentle conversation, he may have built a firewall for all that Iowa history, maybe off with a new start. Listeners, we're talking tonight about the Democratic primary campaign going national. Are you getting what you want from the primary campaign so far? From the debates, the conversations, the exposure, do you want to see the nomination sewn up soon? Or do you want the heat and breadth of more voices in the race? This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Democratic primary campaign going national. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you want to see the nomination sewn up soon? Or do you want the heat and breadth of more voices in the race on the campaign trail? Is the system working? Is it producing a contender for the White House? What do you think? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from Phoenix, Arizona, by John Kamen. He's chief political reporter for the Arizona Republic. John Kamen, great to have you. Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
So you are in the big seven states that see a primary or a caucus next Tuesday, primary in Arizona's case. What does it look like for the candidates down there? Who's playing strong? What can you see?
Well, Arizona and New Mexico are the first states in the West to be voting. As you know, in the past, South Carolina has been the next stop after New Hampshire. This time around, it's really quite different. The candidates are coming west. They're going to Oklahoma. It really is a diversity election. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the issues in Arizona and New Mexico have to do with immigration and some forestation policy and some water and issues that have not emerged at all in Iowa and New Hampshire.
So despite the fact that they haven't emerged in those states, do Arizonans, for one state, have a read on where these candidates stay? Do people feel like they even know yet, or is that yet to be unfolded this week?
That's the next question. No, I don't think that any of the candidates have really put together comprehensive answers to some of the questions that Arizonans might have. And, of course, everything happens so fast after Iowa and New Hampshire, there isn't any opportunity for the glad handing across the state. Some of the candidates have been here, but they probably will make only one brief appearance before Tuesday's election. So we're still left a little bit in the dark about exactly what we would get on the issues that may be important to the West.
John, when you talk to Democrats in Arizona, are they pleased with the front runners that have come out of Iowa and New Hampshire? Are Kerry and Dean the men that they hoped would be in the lead? Were they hoping that they'd see, I don't know, Wesley Clark up there, John Edwards up there? Are these the front runners that they hoped to find?
Well, Wesley Clark is still very popular here, and until Iowa, it really was a two-person race between Clark and Dean. Immediately after Iowa, the polls that we conducted and the couple of university polls showed that Kerry was very quickly on top, not by very much, but the latest standings are Kerry and Clark and then Dean some distance behind. That isn't too meaningful because some one-third of the Arizona voters were still undecided, and they could go anywhere.
And what about the ethnic makeup of voters in the Democratic primary in Arizona? The candidates have just come out of two very white states. Is there a more diverse electorate awaiting them in Arizona of people who are likely to vote in this primary or not?
Well, tremendously diverse. Whether they are likely to vote is another question. This is the first full-scale, state-run Democratic primary, presidential primary that we've had. And Joe Lieberman, for instance, has spent a great deal of time cultivating the Hispanic and Indian communities, which are quite sizable. I don't know that that really is going to pay off for him, but all of the candidates have focused especially on the Hispanic population. We one-third of this state is minority group members, and that includes some 25% of the state that is of Hispanic ancestry. So it's a huge Democratic voting bloc, and it's also very important for some of the issues that that are important to those people.
And not a block that any of these candidates have been tested on so far this season. John Cameron, I hope we can catch up with you again next week. I want to thank you for joining us tonight from Phoenix.
My pleasure.
John Cameron is chief political reporter for the Arizona Republic. I want to turn now to Silver Spring, Maryland, where we're joined by John Harwood, political editor for the Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, John Harwood.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. John, what do you see in store for this big, still fairly large field of Democratic candidates as they move out of these two states and onto the big national stage? How does the chemistry change?
It's going to change dramatically to the benefit of John Kerry. John Kerry rolls out of New Hampshire with tremendous momentum. All of his challengers are more or less out of money. And John Kerry is the one who is going to ride a publicity wave, going to have cameras in front of him everywhere he goes in these seven states. It's going to help his fundraising, which makes it easier for him to launch TV ads in all those seven states as he's done today. And meantime, you see Howard Dean's campaign is in disarray. His campaign manager, Joe Trippi, quit today.
Mm-hmm.
And others are struggling just to find some place to win. The best spot for that may be South Carolina, where John Edwards, in the state of his birth, is going to make a last stand.
Now, but what about that more national audience in terms of their interests and maybe their appetites for what they want in a candidate? Are they going to see John Kerry differently or just see the front-runner status, take that, in a well-spoken man and his record and go with it?
Well, first of all, it's pretty clear that the overarching issue for Democrats this year is finding somebody to beat Bush. It's not policy disputes of one kind or the other. Those simply aren't important in this race. We saw that in Iowa, where the vast majority of caucus participants war, but nevertheless, they favored John Kerry, who had voted for the war.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Democratic primary electorate nationally is quite liberal as compared to the general populations in those states. So even though South Carolina is a state where Democrats have no chance whatsoever to win in the general election, it's a place where John Kerry, where Howard Dean, when he was riding high, was leading, and where John Kerry could well win.
Even in South Carolina. Let me ask you a question about the John Dean campaign, John Harwood. Joe Trippi, if I've got this right, not so long ago was talking with some journalists and articulated something along these lines, that maybe the Dean campaign would hang back, a la Jerry Brown, while Kerry won a few, collecting enough delegates, and then come back when and if Kerry flagged later, and make a later in the game charge for dominance. In other words, kind of surrender some states here and then come on strong later. Did you hear that? And might that have gotten him in trouble with Howard Dean? Is that why he's out tonight?
Well, in fact, that's what the Dean campaign has decided to do. Joe Trippi was in favor of that strategy, and ultimately Howard Dean has settled on that strategy. He's just got a new campaign manager to implement it in Roy Neal, the former Gore aide.
It sounds like last night Howard Dean told us, when we asked him where he's headed next, one of the first states he mentioned was Michigan, which is not even in the lineup next Tuesday.
Exactly.
It's later next week.
Exactly. He's going to Michigan. He's going to go to the state of Washington. He's likely to go to Maine. Now, he is going to go to South Carolina for a debate on Thursday night, and he is going to stop in Missouri, but he is not likely to aggressively compete because he and his remaining strategists left behind after Joe Trippi's departure know that they can't do well next week.
Wow. I mean, that seems like a risky strategy. If they don't do well on Tuesday, can they still pick up the pieces in Michigan, what is it, 4 or 5 days later?
That's right. I think it's highly doubtful. When you get desperate in a campaign, you try unorthodox things, but the writing is on the wall for Howard Dean. He was badly beaten in Iowa and New Hampshire, both of which are places where he had led. New Hampshire's ideal turf for him because of the number of upscale liberals there who represent his primary target audience. In Iowa, he had the opportunity in a small turnout caucus situation to bring all these new voters to the polls that he talked about bringing. It just didn't happen, and it's not likely to happen for Howard Dean now that John Kerry's in a much, much stronger position nationally.
But he may be looking for that Hail Mary in Michigan. Tony's calling from Boston. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I've been a Kerry supporter since last March, and I've seen the ups and downs, and we threw an event in December, and we had to twist arms and cut the price to get people to come. We eventually got them, but it didn't look good. And
that's only a few weeks ago, Tony.
I know, and I was in New Hampshire yesterday, and I was at two different offices working for Kerry, and they kept running out of things for people to do because people just kept showing up. So I think some of the enthusiasm that Dean had has been transferred over to Kerry, and it's an enthusiasm to beat Bush is what I've seen.
And why do you think that's flowed into Kerry's pocket, Tony? What's your analysis?
Well, I think he's shown some resilience and that he's a fighter. I mean, he's used that term, and you don't want to overuse it, but I think there's something to that he hung in there, and I think people see that he has a lot of the characteristics, the strength, the seriousness that they want. Seriousness sometimes looks like aloofness, but I think people are deciding they want someone serious.
Tony, we got it. Thanks for your call. Jack Beatty, we have to pinch ourselves still. It is still remarkable that it was so few weeks ago that John Kerry was seen as just sucking wind, going nowhere.
Yes, and he talked about a Hail Mary strategy. He was going to win New Hampshire by going through Iowa, and it worked big time. I agree with John. The momentum is all with him, and Democrats want a winner above all. And what's interesting about Kerry's appeal in New Hampshire, there's a scholar at St. Anselm's, Dante Scala, who wrote a book saying that it really matters, the nature of the vote the Democrats get. If a Democrat in New Hampshire gets upscale liberals and suburbs and working-class voters, this has meant good things for them in the fall. And he was talking last night about analyzing Kerry's performance, mm-hmm. strong in Manchester, working-class town, mm-hmm. Strong in Rochester, also working-class town, but also very strong in Bow, which is a upscale suburb.
So the glossy suburbs and the blue-collar
He's uniting the Democratic Party, in other words, behind him.
John, Jack, I want to turn quickly here to Columbia, Missouri. We're joined by Josh Flory. He's political reporter for the Columbia Daily Tribune in Columbia, Missouri. Good evening. Welcome, Josh Flory.
Thank you. How are you doing?
We're doing great. Josh, thanks for joining us. Of course, Dick Gephardt is out of this race now, and that has put Missouri and its pretty good stack of candidate delegates up for grabs. Who's looking strong in Missouri, Josh?
The Kansas City Star this morning had a poll that showed John Kerry, obviously using that momentum from New Hampshire, he had about 25%. The other candidates, none of them were out of the single digits, it looked like.
Even Wesley Clark from neighboring Arkansas.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Apparently so.
And how did Howard Dean look today?
Well, Dean was also down, according to the Stars poll, I think about 8%, so single digits also. So that's the only poll I've seen so far. But as you said, none of the campaigns had really made much of an effort here until Gephardt dropped out, which has only been a week ago now.
Josh, is Dick Gephardt likely to tip his hat toward any particular candidate? Do you know? Can you tell?
From what I've heard, he's not. He is told his supporters to not vote for him, which had been a possibility some had considered, but I don't believe he's made an endorsement. From what I hear, I don't think he's going to make one before the primary either.
So that may be more happy hunting grounds for Kerry in Missouri. Josh Flory, I hope we can catch up with you next week. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David's calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Good. Yeah, I'd like to make a few points. First of all, you know, I'm not ready to see the primaries run down very quickly because I think actually each of the candidates is adding something to the dialogue.
Yeah, I agree. It really has added something, hasn't it? It's made it so robust.
You know, even people who, you know, really had no possible chance of winning, like Kucinich, I think, and
Al Sharpton has pepped things up there.
You know, they were just all just, you know, terrific people and really making good points. But the thing is, I think in the long run, my prediction is that the ticket is going to be Clark and Edwards.
Really?
And I just sort of like to make a comment as to why.
Just please.
And I think regardless of the fact that Kerry has all this momentum now, he's still seen by an awful lot of people as a Northeastern liberal. And I think the liberal tag will outweigh the war hero tag, unless he makes some sort of speech that says, well, if you mean by liberal that I do this and I do that, then yes, I'm a liberal. But barring that, I think he'll be seen as a liberal, and I think that we do have to elect people and elect a Democrat, and I think what Dean has done has shown us not just how bad Bush is, but how dangerous he is.
But, David, let me ask you, do you think that liberal tag, if that's what sticks to Kerry, will drag him down even among Democratic primary voters?
Well, No, not that's.
I mean, that's who we're talking about in this next round.
Voters, but I mean, well, but in the long run, if people are looking at electability, they have to think about, well, who else, and you know, who's going to vote for this guy?
Yeah, we've got it, David. Thanks very much for your call, John Harwood. How about that concern that ultimately that tag comes around to bite John Kerry?
Well, it might bite John Kerry eventually, although there are complexities in his record which suggests he'll be able to deal with that charge perhaps more effectively than Mike Dukakis did in 1988 when he ran against the current president's father. But I'm very interested in the other point that that David made, which had to do with whether or not this process is going to be shut down very quickly. In the campaigns that I've covered, there is usually a fairly strong desire, which has gotten stronger over time, to shut it down quickly. And just before this program, I was talking to a dean strategist up in Burlington, mm-hmm. Vermont, who was saying, so here's the question. Are Democratic voters ready to say, and the Democratic establishment, ready to say next week, we want to end this thing now, or do they want to see it go on because it might strengthen the party as it moves on toward larger states? My suspicion is the answer is yes, they do want to shut it down, but Howard Dean and his people left behind after Joe Tripi's departure are betting that they can keep this thing open, keep it alive, and try to come back over a longer time frame.
Big new card we haven't talked about much tonight, but it will be a strong issue in South Carolina, ethnicity and race. We mentioned it before, but it's been a white electorate so far, a big black population of voters in South Carolina. Jim Clyburn, the black congressman there endorsing John Kerry today. How do you expect ethnicity and race to show up in this next round, John Harwood?
Well, it's African Americans are likely to be about half the vote in South Carolina. So even though that's a favorable state for John Edwards, John Kerry is going to want to compete and show well there because African Americans are a tremendous part of the Democratic constituency. He wants to plant his flag there and do well, and Jim Clyburn is a big step in that direction. You're also going to see, of course, as you discussed earlier, the Hispanic vote playing a large role in both Arizona and New Mexico.
And what about Al Sharpton? We've heard him say, give me your vote in South Carolina and I'll take it for leverage at the Democratic convention. How much of the vote there do you think he might pull away?
Well, that's a very interesting point, and it may have an influence over whether John Edwards or John Kerry wins that state. Polls a few weeks ago were showing that Al Sharpton was drawing about one-third of the black vote, which is pretty substantial for somebody who's from New York and isn't a particularly well-known presence in the South. Every vote that he takes away is a vote that Edwards or Kerry doesn't get. I suspect it hurts Edwards a little bit more, since Edwards, as a Southerner from a neighboring state, might have a little more cachet with African Americans.
And John, a last question. John Edwards today saying on NBC, I do not want to be vice president. Do you believe it?
Oh, I believe he doesn't want to be. I think he wants to be the presidential nominee, but I do not believe that he wouldn't take it if he were asked to do it.
John Harwood, it's always great talking with you. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You bet.
John Harwood, political editor for the Wall Street Journal. Well, Jack, there it is. Another one down. 7 coming up in a week. And, I don't hear anybody. Well, a few voices, but John Kerry's getting an awful lot of applause still tonight after New Hampshire.
He is. And on the Edwards matter, you know, he was the write-in choice of New Hampshire Democrats for vice president.
So that tells us.
That tells us we may have a ticket there.
whether he wants it or not,
right.
It may be his seat in the limo.
Yes.
Jack, it was great being in Manchester with you last night and great having you with us again tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. After the break, the WMD controversy continues on both sides of the Atlantic. Former weapons inspector David Kaye testifies in Washington, and Britain's Prime Minister Tony Blair dodges a bullet with the Hutton Report. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The much-anticipated Hutton Report was released today in London, and it explicitly exonerates Prime Minister Tony Blair on charges that he lied to Parliament last year about the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The report instead casts an unflattering light on the BBC and its editorial process, which Lord Hutton called defective. Philip Stevens is associate editor at the Financial Times in London. I asked him earlier about the report's key findings.
The key findings from Lord Hutton's report today really split into two categories. The first was that the central charges against Tony Blair's government and they were that the government had embellished the intelligence information that it had about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program. Mm-hmm.
Sexed up, the phrase was.
Sexed up, as the terrible phrase had it. That charge, Lord Hutton found to be false, that he said it was perfectly clear that however right or wrong the intelligence may have turned out to be, there wasn't any evidence that the politicians had meddled or sexed up or fabricated intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
On the second charge against the government, that it had somehow hounded this poor weapons scientist, David Kelly, who worked for its own Ministry of Defense. Mr. Kelly was the person who had talked to a BBC reporter, mm-hmm. and that led to this chain of events that led him to commit suicide and the BBC to lay these charges against the government. Lord Hutton found that the government hadn't behaved absolutely perfectly towards Dr. Kelly, but had not actually hounded him in such a way that led him to take his own life.
So it's a pretty clean bill of health then for Tony Blair coming out of this today. How important was this for the Prime Minister?
I think it was critically important because the charge essentially that the British Broadcasting Corporation, and it must be said lots of other news organisations in Britain had laid against the government, was that Tony Blair had basically deceived the nation when he took it to war. And in a sense, as Lord Hutton himself said, you know, there can't really be a graver charge against a prime minister. So it was absolutely vital. Had Lord Hutton given the slightest intimation that he felt that the Prime Minister had been duplicitous in this, Mr. Blair wouldn't have survived.
Philip Stevens, how is this being received in Britain? Lord Hutton, the judge, was appointed by Tony Blair to look at certain questions. Does this seem to give the Blair government a complete bill of health, saying that there was no exaggeration of any kind around WMD that went into the decision to go to war? Or is it more particularly tied to the details of this particular case and allegation about around David Kelly and the BBC?
No, I think on the central question, did the government embellish, exaggerate, invent or fabricate the intelligence, Lord Hutton is very clear. He does at one point raise a question about whether intelligence should be used by the government to make a case for war and whether that is the appropriate way of doing things. But even there, he basically exonerates the government from real blame because he accepts the central point that the intelligence chiefs themselves signed off on everything the government published. So although there will be people, including those in the media, who had already pronounced the government guilty before the verdict came, who will sort of query and quibble, but I think that Tony Blair couldn't have hoped for a better report in terms of his own integrity. The other side of Lord Hutton's report is that he is very critical, shockingly critical in some respects, of the way the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, firstly put out this story on the radio, secondly refused to investigate it, and thirdly got into this confrontation with the government about whether the initial story had been accurate. What basically happened was the story was broadcast by Andrew Gilligan, the BBC reporter, based, he said, later on a conversation with Dr. David Kelly. This produced an enormous political row, argument in Britain, denied vehemently by the government. David Kelly, the weapons scientist who'd actually had talked to the BBC reporter, got caught up in this hurricane of controversy and driven, I think, partly by his own attempts to protect himself, but also by his own confusions. He very tragically took his own life.
Tony Blair has expressed enormous satisfaction in the judges, Lord Hutton's findings today, and has asked for the BBC to right the wrong. We see news that the chairman of the BBC, Gavin Davies, has resigned. Is that right?
Yes. And I was just talking to one of the governors of the BBC, one of Mr. Davies's colleagues. This has thrown the BBC into the biggest crisis perhaps in its history. Gavin Davies, who's the chairman of the governors, the most senior figure at the BBC, has basically done, I think, the honourable thing. And having seen all this criticism from Lord Hutton of the BBC's editorial procedures, its journalistic standards, has said, well, I'm the person at the top, I must go. This has left, frankly, the BBC in some turmoil. There will possibly be other resignations from the management of the BBC, but unquestionably, the BBC is now going to have to rethink its editorial standards, the way it conducts its journalism.
Philip Stevens, thanks for joining us from London.
Thank you.
Philip Stevens is associate editor at the Financial Times. Tony Blair declared at a tense House of Commons meeting earlier today that he was vindicated by the Hutton Report. He demanded apologies from the BBC for suggesting he had misrepresented intelligence and from British conservatives for charging his government had maliciously leaked David Kelly's name. Here's an excerpt from Tony Blair's speech.
It is absolutely right that people can question whether the intelligence received was right and why we have not yet found weapons of mass destruction. There is an entirely legitimate argument about the wisdom of the conflict. I happen to believe now, as I did in March, that removing Saddam has made the world a safer and better place. But others are entirely entitled to disagree. However, all of this is of a completely different order from a charge of deception, of duplicity, of deceit, a charge that I or anyone else deliberately falsified intelligence. The truth about that charge is now found. No intelligence was inserted into the dossier by Downing Street. Nothing was put in it against the wishes of the intelligence services. No one, either in Downing Street or in the Joint Intelligence Committee, put any intelligence into it, probably knowing it was wrong. And no such claim to the BBC was made by anyone in charge of drawing up that dossier. Indeed, Lord Hutton's findings go further. He finds the claim was not even made by Dr. Kelly himself. The allegation that I or anyone else lied to this House or deliberately misled the country by falsifying intelligence on weapons of mass destruction is itself the real lie.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair speaking before Parliament today. There was an echo of the British tempest over WMD claims and counterclaims in Washington today, where former Chief American Weapons Inspector in Iraq, David Kaye, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Kaye said faulty intelligence gathering rather than political pressure was to blame for the belief that Saddam Hussein harbored weapons of mass destruction. Here's an excerpt from David Kaye's testimony.
We were almost all wrong. And I certainly include myself here. Senator Kennedy knows very directly. Senator Kennedy and I talked on several occasions prior to the war that my view was that the best evidence that I had seen was that Iraq indeed had weapons of mass destruction. I would also point out that many governments that chose not to support this war, certainly the French President Chirac, as I recall, in April of last year, referred to Iraq's possession of WMD. The German certainly, the intelligence service believed that there were WMD. It turns out we were all wrong, probably, in my judgment. And that is most disturbing. We're also in a period in which we've had intelligence surprises in the proliferation area that go the other way. The case of Iran, a nuclear program that the Iranians admit was 18 years old, that we underestimated. And that, in fact, we didn't discover. It was discovered by a group of Iranian dissidents outside the country who pointed the international community at the location. The Libyan program, recently discovered, was far more extensive than was assessed prior to that. There's a long record here of being wrong. There's good reason for it. There are probably multiple reasons. Certainly, proliferation is a hard thing to track, particularly in countries that deny easy and free access and don't have free and open societies.
David Kaye, who resigned last week as head of the Iraq Survey Group, he was tasked with finding evidence of weapons of mass destruction there. He told the Senate Armed Services Committee today that he had not found such evidence. Joining me now to talk about the implications of the Hutton Report and David Kaye's testimony is Mark Hosenball, investigative correspondent at Newsweek magazine. Good evening and welcome, Mark Hosenball.
How are you doing?
Well, great. Thanks for joining us. Mark, what do you make of this? First, on the American side, I guess looking at both sides, you had two governments that have been under fairly heavy fire recently for misrepresenting, perhaps deliberately misrepresenting, the threat of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Some different conclusions today, but each in their own way trying or maybe putting paid to some of these charges. Is the lid being put on this, or is this still a very open issue?
Well, I think the lid's pretty clearly been put on in England. You know, oddly enough, Lord Hutton's investigation through its testimony and through the publication on its website of all kinds of internal government documents kind of really opened up the process as to the way the British government works in a way that's never been done before in the modern history of Britain at that kind of high level. And it did show that the government was, you know, at least picking bits of intelligence that sounded sexy for its dossier, though they were bits of intelligence and some intelligence officials went along with it. But it also showed that the internal documents did show that there were people in the intelligence community in Britain, particularly at the Defense Ministry, who dissented from that view. So a lot of stuff was sort of put out there in documents to suggest the government was at least playing around with the intelligence a little bit and ignoring dissent, and yet the judge seems to have completely ignored that. So and he's really given Blair a ringing endorsement and completely gone after the BBC. In the same way, in a sort of different, almost parallel universe, but the British government really wanted to get the BBC for a whole variety of reasons, so they went after the BBC, kind of shoot the messenger. That's sort of a little bit what's happening here in the United States. The policymakers are the ones who made the decisions to go to war in Iraq. It wasn't really clear to me, as somebody who deals with intelligence issues quite a lot since September 11th, that the intelligence agencies at all were kind of urging them on and that they believed that that Iraq, you know, necessarily was particularly, I guess the word is imminent threat, although they never said, the policymakers say they never said that. But in any case, you know, the policymakers did pick the bits of CIA and Defense Department material that supported their view that Saddam was a very dangerous threat who had WMD.
So what do you make of David Kaye's testimony then today? What do you make of David Kaye's testimony? He's saying today, he said, quote, almost in a perverse way, I wish it had been undue influence, that is political influence, because we know how to correct that.
No. But what he's saying is that there's an allegation of political pressure on the intelligence agency.
Yes.
An allegation which has been made, but it's not been substantiated. What I'm saying is the intelligence agencies often issue products that basically kind of can be read to say almost anything. You look at it and it says Saddam may have weapons of mass destruction, we can't rule out this, we can't rule that, and then you see in a footnote, yeah, but some people don't think he does, or we haven't actually seen any traces of this stuff for years. And, you know, people don't look at the footnotes in these things and pick out the language, and they put that in the speeches, and they can say, well, the CIA said that, the CIA did say that. And it is true that the CIA, as Mr. Kaye pointed out, you know, doesn't necessarily have very good sources in places like Iraq, and they rely very heavily, as Mr. Kaye pointed out, on foreign intelligence services for their information. But it's not just the CIA that made misjudgments here, if misjudgments were made. You know, the policymakers, you know, arguably looked at those bits of intelligence that supported their view and didn't necessarily look at the bits of intelligence that didn't support their view.
Mark Hosenbelt, Tony Blair may be off the hook on the issues he faced, but what about the Bush administration? Democrats today on Capitol Hill read quote after quote from very high administration officials who had asserted that Iraq had these weapons and they were a danger. Is there an investigation that might yet prove a political threat to George Bush in all this?
Well, no, not really. The Senate Intelligence Committee is conducting an investigation of the Iraqi intelligence, but they're kind of trying to focus this investigation on the methodology of the CIA and how the CIA estimates were produced in a way that led policymakers to misinterpret them, I guess. But they're putting the blame mainly here on the CIA. The Democrats of the Senate Intelligence Committee are kind of flailing around and saying that the investigation should be wider, but they as a minority party, they seem to lack an awful lot of power to do much about it. And
so we come to some kind of conclusion that's not exactly a conclusion. Mark Hosenbaum, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Mark Hosenbaum, investigative correspondent at Newsweek magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.